Welcome back to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Today, we're talking about a new book, The Elimination Diet. And in this part two of today's podcast, in part one, we established the rationale for elimination diets. In part two, we're going to talk about some of the practical issues in implementation of an elimination diet. So, Tom, you actually mentioned that there should be some stages in implementing an elimination diet. In other words, I mean, the practical question is how restrictive does it have to be? You know, where do you start? How do you transition back to a more normal diet? When do you know when to add back foods?
Oh, such a great question. And, you know, it really depends on the particular person. So the person who comes in and follows the exact diet published in our book is a person who's tried everything else. It's a person who's has the terrible eczema or psoriasis, they have the terrible migraines, they have the terrible irritable bowel, and they haven't been able to find success. And they're willing to just change their life. They're willing to start cooking from scratch, following lots of videos of cooking instruction, following lots of recipes, and really get
which, by the way, are in the book. There's some a lot of practical recipes in the book.
Absolutely, and we have the videos online and whatnot. So, yes, we have all the resources for you when you're ready to jump in with both feet, but Dr. Hoffman, you and I both know the average person isn't ready and or willing to jump in with both feet if they're on a standard American diet and are just hearing about this now and they're saying, wait a second, what's the least I can do to get the most benefit now? And I would say,
the biggest bang for your buck.
Yeah. I would say that's easy. Well, what I would say is, you know, try going gluten and dairy-free first. Those two go hand in hand. And in fact, we see even with celiac patients, those who are reacting to gluten, if you put dairy into their intestinal tract, 50% of them will react identically that they do to gluten. So if you're having a reaction to gluten, which is very, very common, you're more likely to have a reaction to dairy. So you just take the two of them out together, and you go for a while without that. Now, we have entire cookbooks. We've been teaching this for the last 8 years on gluten-free, dairy-free living. So our Whole Life Nutrition Cookbook, you can find that on our website, wholelifenutrition.net as well. There are plenty of resources online for looking for gluten-free, dairy-free recipes. Just try that for 2 weeks. 2 weeks. And if you can get it out 100%, then the chances are you will notice what you've got going on there if it's associated with gluten and dairy. Now, that works for the vast majority of people. Not for everybody, but the vast majority of people. But notice I said something. I said, if you can get it out 100%. Now, this is a challenge in the United States. We live in the United States of glutinous and dairyous. I mean, everywhere right. You go, there's going to be wheat flour in something. There's going to be some sort of wheat in the fryer. There's going to be wheat on the grill. There's going to be some sort of residue of gluten or some sort of residue of milk somewhere, and there's this incredible phenomenon called cross-contamination. And what I see in my clinical practice, have seen over the years, is a lot of people don't get better until you take out every little hidden source of the gluten and dairy.
So this is not a 90-10 thing. A lot of people think, look, I'm on a diet, so weekdays I'm very, very disciplined, but I have my big sort of blowout meal on Saturday. But it works in aggregate. I lose some weight, and I got to have a pressure valve once in a while. But with this, you have to be very rigorous, right?
This has been extremely clear. If you even look back in the 1800s in some of the written medical literature, you can see that they were very clear in showing if you're going to intervene with celiac diets or banana-based diets or whatever it was, they would always state, you have to keep every possible contamination source out if you want to see drastic changes in your health. So Dr. Alessio Fasano, he's part of the scientific roundtable at the Autism Research Institute, and I did an interview with him, and I said, Alessio, here's what I'm recommending in my clinical practice all the time. I'm saying 100% effort equals 100% results. If you want to really find results, then you've got to take out every little known hidden source. Otherwise, you're not going to feel better. And he said, Tom, 99% effort equals zero results.
Right. So in other words, it's not clear if you don't get results whether the diet failed you or you failed the diet, because if you didn't implement it properly, well, maybe you're not going to see the results and you'll dismiss this whole process by saying, well, it really wasn't worthwhile because I mostly did it and I didn't notice a difference.
And that's I would have to say, is the biggest downfall for most people. It's what I call unintentional consumption of the foods, or small intentional consumptions, where people say, look, one bite of a cookie is not going to kill me, or just a little bit of pancake is not, you know, the communion wafer on Sunday, I have to do that, it's part of my religion. You know, those little pieces go a long way. And come on, we know this when it comes to any other immune disorder. If you say, okay, I'm going to worry about catching the flu, or I'm going to worry about catching Ebola, or whatever it is, you know it takes a teeny, teeny exposure to excite your entire immune system. Whereas, you know, people for some reason think you have to have an entire muffin to excite it with food. It doesn't take that much at all. In fact, if you look at the data from the FDA, I mean, it takes less than 20 parts per million of gluten to excite somebody's immune system, and some would argue it takes even less than that. That's teeny. That's a teeny, teeny fragment. So really, getting that stuff out and keeping it out for your time frame of at least 2 weeks is incredibly, incredibly important. So that's a challenge for a lot of people, but those who rise to the challenge elevate their lives to a new level. I would say the vast majority, 80+% of the people in my clinical practice come to me with, you name it, whether they've got chronic fatigue, fibromyalgia, MS, lupus, whatever they have, if they can go on a strict elimination diet and keep all the sources out for a couple of weeks, usually it's within the first 3 to 5 days that they see gallbladder symptoms improve, headaches improve. They'll see within the first 10 to 12 days, they'll see a lot of weight loss, number one. Number two, they'll start seeing their energy increase, their mental acuity. By the time they're done, many of them say, I feel 20 years younger. Like, what just happened here? Like, all of a sudden, this veil is lifted over me, and I can see the world through this incredible new viewpoint. I'm higher now. So, you know, that's what we're shooting for. It's not a process of deprivation. It's a process of liberation. We're trying to just lift people out of these constant responses they're having 3 to 5 times a day to their foods.
And what are some surprising hidden sources of wheat, dairy, or some of the other culprits, sugar, corn, soy, and yeast, you know, that people don't really think about?
Medications. I've actually had some clients who've had severe arthritis issues that clear up when they switch from their 150 milligram dose of medication to 275 milligram doses that don't have corn additives or excipients or colorings. I've seen people who, you know, eat sushi all the time, and they're like, look, it's just rice and seaweed. And I'm like, yeah, ask the people behind the counter, do they put any wheat flour? Oh, actually, they make their rice stickier with a little bit of wheat flour. Same with, you know, Mexican sauces. They're often adding in a little bit of wheat flour. There are so many hidden sources out there when it comes to toothpaste, lotions, creams. You know, some people are so sensitive that they'll respond on their scalp. It's not so common. But
And you list those in your book as well, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, our website is a resource, so I'm hoping people will check out the website, and we have some lists.
And once again, that's wholelifenutrition.net, correct?
Right, wholelifenutrition.net. And what you're going to see is we're going to be putting up more hidden sources of things like soy and corn and gluten, because those are the toughest, I think, to avoid. Soy is hidden in things. It'll be listed as something called soy lecithin, or, you know, conventional vitamin E oil. Sometimes they're made of wheat germ oil. You'll find it in a lot of different hidden places. So we'll do our best to light those up for you.
Should sugar be part of an elimination diet?
Such a great question. You know, yes, absolutely. And it turns out when you do panels, I like to rely more on the elimination diet than I do on allergy panels. You know, a lot of people will do the IgG4 panels or the ALCAT testing, whatever they're going to do. And those are great. They can really pick up some interesting things. But one of the things I noticed is, you know, sugar was starting to show up on those panels. I was like, oh, wow, really, the immune system's reacting to the protein structures in sugar? Wow, that's fascinating. But I'm also curious. I wonder if it's on top of that, some of the maybe adulteration that could be happening to the sugar. I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of genetically modified sugar beets these days, and we're now seeing in the literature that both the cane sugar that's conventional and the beet sugar that's conventional may have chemical residues on them. So I don't know if the people are reacting to the chemical residues or what. But
or sugar per se, you know, just because of its chemical properties, might be, you know, sort of like lighter fluid for allergies.
Well, Absolutely. And we know that when you elevate sugar in your system, it's kind of a fascinating process, right? I mean, it's like a biological experiment in your kitchen that you've done with rock candy, where you supersaturate sugar in a liquid, and then you cool that liquid, and then it starts forming crystals, and it sticks onto a string and forms that rock candy. It's, you know, it's wild how when you put a high enough concentration of sugar in your system, how you start sticking to proteins. You know, you'll stick to something called hemoglobin. You'll form something called hemoglobin A1C, right? And this hemoglobin, or sugar stuck to glycosylated hemoglobin, sugar stuck to hemoglobin, doesn't work. Your hemoglobin can't do what it's supposed to be doing.
So that's not the only protein, the protein in your blood that you're glycosylating. You're glycosylating proteins everywhere in your body, in your heart, your brain, your skin. Yep.
Absolutely. So when you form these sugar stuck to proteins, guess what? The immune system doesn't recognize them. And so the immune system is surveying around looking for very familiar substances, and it sees this funky looking you know, structure that has a sugar stuck to it and says, I don't know what that is. I'm going to get enraged by that and start secreting a bunch of chemicals that can lead to joint pains and migraines and skin conditions and all sorts of different things. So absolutely, absolutely, you increase inflammation in the presence of sugar, which can exacerbate any sort of response you're having to food as well.
Can chemicals and food additives cause inflammation?
Yeah, that's
a rhetorical question, if you hadn't noticed.
Absolutely. And, you know, who's done a brilliant job on this is Feingold. He's really put together his wonderful research on looking at children who are having responses to food additives and food colorings. He did a lot of great stuff on the tartrazine, the yellow dye number 5, and some of the red 40s and whatnot. And looking at how the chemicals, we have over 10,000 food additive chemicals that are in use in the United States. And, you know, commonly people look at these structures, whether they're preservatives like sulfites or there's some of these salicylate phenol type structures in some of the food colorings. When their immune systems see these things, they're like, whoa, I don't know how to metabolize that. I don't know how to process that very well. I might end up having complexes formed by that and then launching an immune attack. So, yeah, food additives are definitely problematic.
And what about switching from conventional to organic produce, fruits and vegetables? Is that crucial?
I would have to say absolutely. Number one, you are reducing your own exposure to pesticides. That's incredibly important, whether it's an herbicide, insecticide, fungicide. There's plenty of data out there now, plenty of data showing how these change immune cell function incredibly strongly, I should say, and it's more powerful than you would want to give it credit, unfortunately, and they also shift the microbiome. Remember those friends that train our immune cells? So these residues are incredibly potent at causing problems. What we're also seeing, though, is some of the chemical compounds, the flavonoids that we find in fruits and vegetables, are higher in organic produce. You know, there's all these studies trying to prove that organic is the same as conventional, and they never can prove that because these plant defense compounds are usually higher in the organic produce. So those might protect some tissues. They might help with intestinal function. They might help keep you in normal balance, provide antioxidants to actually nourish and replenish tissue. So, I would say there's no question in my mind that even if I don't put people on elimination diets, if I just say clean up your diet, stop the packaged foods and go organic, we see symptoms getting better. So absolutely, organic, absolutely.
In your book, you actually include GMOs, genetically modified organisms, as part of the allergy problem. What difficulties do they pose for people with food intolerances?
Well, sure, and that's just me diving into the data, looking at the particular protein structures, things like trypsin inhibitors in soy, for example, that will be quite a few times higher in the GMO soy versus the conventional soy. And, you know, you need to break your food down. I mean, that's an entire process called digestion, right? Breaking from large to small. And a trypsin inhibitor being elevated in a legume like a soy, for example, those actually increase the inhibition of your ability to break down proteins. So you end up with protein structures that are larger and can confuse the immune cell. So I would say there's been a drastic rise in allergies since the introduction of GMOs, and while people say there's possible no connection, there's also a possible connection. You have to change the protein structure when you genetically modify a food. That's how you genetically modify it.
And you create novel proteins.
You create a protein structure that you cannot control. You have no idea what it is ultimately. The way you insert genes, it's not placed in an exact position on the DNA. They shoot them in, or they use viral connectors to get it in there, but they don't know. It's not an exact science. So no one can predict what proteins come out of that genetically modified food. So absolutely, there's a potential, and even FDA scientists warned against it, there's a potential for someone to have excessive allergenic reactions. They might be eating a corn and see a protein structure coming from that corn that looks like a Brazil nut, for example. And if they have a Brazil nut allergy, they can actually have a full-blown anaphylactic response to corn because it's expressing something that looks like Brazil nut. So it's a risky, risky thing if you're trying to reduce food sensitivities to keep consuming GMOs.
You mentioned earlier FODMAPs. Can you give people a brief introduction to that concept? Because that's a type of food intolerance that certainly is not a classic something that's going to be picked up with allergy testing in a conventional allergist's office, but it nonetheless is important for a lot of especially gastrointestinal symptoms.
Oh, yeah, gas, nausea, bloating. Bloating and distension primarily you'll see a lot, and then you'll have something that you'll hear your clients say. They'll say, I have, you know, sticky or gooey poop. And so you'll go, that's interesting. After you consume what? And most commonly, it's apples, applesauce, apple juice, pears, things that are high in these particular substances that feed bacterium elegantly. So we call them FODMAPs. They're fermentable foods, meaning the bacterium like to consume them. These fermentable foods are the oligosaccharides, disaccharides, monosaccharides, and polyols. It's just basically scientific names for structures that bacterium love to consume. And if you have bloating, distension after eating, you have to loosen up your belt, you know, every time after you eat. I have one gal who goes up two belt sizes, you know, after she eats certain foods, and I, you've got bacterial overgrowth. Let's lower the FODMAP foods, these foods that feed the bacterium, and watch how your distension goes away. It's amazing. It's really powerful. So in our elimination diet program, if there's a person who has irritable bowel-like symptoms, they have the bloating, gas, nausea, distension, then we recommend they choose our low FODMAP option, our low FODMAP recipes, and those symptoms usually improve tremendously.
So you provide sort of a guide to a variety of elimination diets that people can select according to their symptoms and tailor to their own personal issues, correct?
Yeah, we call them adaptations to the diet. So we have one core diet, and then depending on your symptoms and where you're at, you can make modifications to the diet that will bring you greater success.
Nightshades. Tell us about nightshades. They're a culprit for some people for certain conditions, correct?
Oh, yeah. Some skin conditions, definitely a lot of joint conditions. The Solanaceae family of vegetables, this is the potato, this is the tomato, this is the pepper, this is the eggplant. So you've got the nightshades have particular chemicals in them that are tough for some people to break down. And if they can't break them down, they can bioaccumulate, they can cause irritation. So I would say the rates of reaction to nightshades are increasing, and the variability of the symptoms is increasing. So it used to be, everybody used to say, you know, nightshades equal joint pain, right? But now I'm seeing fatigue, I'm seeing skin problems, I'm seeing a lot of different things occurring when people respond to these. So nightshades are definitely something to consider.
On this diet, you know, a lot of people are stymied because you take away wheat, dairy, corn, and one of the real problem meals is breakfast. People can say, what in the heck am I going to have for breakfast? Give us some breakfast ideas from your book. I know you've outlined menus in a detailed fashion in your book and on your website, but, you know, what would that look like for somebody on this diet? Is it extremely arduous? Will they be in a state of terrible deprivation?
Not at all. Not at all. So one of the things we challenge people to do is we challenge them to consider what their current breakfast is. and whether or not that's something to ideally consume. So if you're consuming a bunch of cereal for breakfast, how's your energy around 3 p.m.? You know, what are you craving around noon? So we kind of challenge people to eat dinner for breakfast. We'd say, you know, let's have something hearty. Let's have a vegetable turkey hash, for example, or let's have some sort of consumption of one of my favorite breakfasts, to be honest with you, is these tart cherry chicken tacos.
That sounds pretty good.
Plantain tortilla.
Wow. And I drink tart cherry juice to get rid of my aches and pains after, you know, give me quicker recoveries after exercise. Is that going to work for general inflammation?
Well, absolutely. So you've seen those studies on tart cherries and cherry juice and replacing naproxen for inflammation and pain, I'm sure. So yeah, absolutely. And what we do is we just slow cook the chicken in this tart cherry juice with a little bit of cumin and some herbamare. It's a sea salt infused with herbs and vegetables.
That sounds great.
We add in a little bit of pepper if you want it to taste. And then it just sits in your slow cooker for 6-7 hours. You split it up into shreds with a fork, and then you put it on top of these tortillas. In fact, we give away these recipes right now on our site, just thewholelifenutrition.net. Just go to Elimination Diet, and you'll see we have some free videos showing how to make these recipes. It's super simple, and it's one of the most delicious meals you're ever going to have. Honestly, my wife has hundreds of recipes that are delicious. Go to our Amazon page and look at our reviews on our cookbooks. I mean, they're astronomically high. And really, no one suffers on this diet. All you have to do is learn how to cook these recipes, you know, follow us on our groups. We do these program launches, where I give free webinars and all sorts of different stuff, and I teach you how to not only survive, but thrive on the elimination diet. So never, never do you have to suffer. You're always eating delicious food.
So if you suffer from anorexia nervosa, this book is not for you.
Yeah, well, gosh, I'd say some anorexics actually are having anorexia problems. I've had that in clinical practice where I had a bunch of teenage girls coming in, and they were diagnosed with anorexia bulimia, and it turned out they all had food sensitivities.
In other words, they just honed in on very narrow diet and were hooked on certain foods.
That's right. And they focused on those narrow diets because we found out later they didn't tolerate certain foods. Now, that's not the case at all with all cases like that, but I did see there is a small portion of that population who in fact does have food sensitivities. They consume their foods, they feel nauseous, they throw up, and they get misdiagnosed as being bulimic. But we get rid of their food sensitivities and their emesis stops, and they start gaining weight, and all of a sudden they're no longer diagnosed. So that's a possibility as well.
Interesting. You know, one big dilemma when people come to see me at the Hoffman Center, and I say this to patients, I say, look, our first task is to get you well. And that's hard enough because probably you've been to a lot of doctors and you haven't gotten well. And so, you know, I might be the sixth or seventh or eighth or ninth or tenth doctor you've gone to see. And so that's a big challenge. But then sometimes an even bigger challenge is, okay, I've gotten you well. You know, you've eliminated this, that, and the other thing. You're taking a bunch of supplements. How much of the things that you've done to get well do you need to maintain to stay well? And I said, that's the second challenge. So what do you do about that? When can you add back, and how do you know what to add back?
Great. So the reality is you test the foods back in. So if you've had a reaction to a particular food during the elimination diet, I say, take it out for 3 months. Leave it out for 3 months. And then you challenge it back in. We teach you all about this in the book. You challenge it back in the reintroduction format, where you just eat a couple of servings of that per day, and you sit and watch and document in a journal how that makes you feel. If you have similar symptoms that, you know, flare up of your skin problem, flare up of your gut problem, you have that foggy thinking coming back in, then you say, well, I'm not ready for this. Take it out for another 3 months. If you don't, then boom, you're ready to rock and roll. So I would say you listen to your body, and that's what this whole process teaches you. To listen to your body, and your body will tell you, are you there yet or are you not? And since you've already done the supplementation and you've already done probably gut healing protocols and whatnot, a lot of people will tolerate those foods.
In other words, it may not be forever. There is such a thing as repair and reacquiring certain foods that you once were unable to tolerate.
Absolutely. In fact, many of the food reactions are what's called transitory. They come and go. Some of the big dogs, gluten, dairy, and some people, egg, you know, they may take a very, very long time before they tolerate it. Some people never with gluten. But, you know, the vast majority of them, you know, some of the smaller food groups and whatnot, the nightshades, for example, or FODMAP foods especially, yeah, people tolerate those within a couple of months.
Yeah, because I think the ultimate goal, because we don't want to be the food police forever, and we don't get our jollies out of putting people into deprivation. I'm sure that's the case with you, Tom. And so our goal ultimately is to normalize people's food intake. It may be that they have to forever eliminate chemicalized foods, or maybe a certain targeted food really is the key to their whole food allergy problem, that by eliminating yeast or by eliminating wheat or gluten, that enables them to reacquire other foods after their gastrointestinal tract and their immune system heal, correct?
Absolutely. And the reality is, if they're constantly reacting to the foods they're eating, then their gut is not at peace. They can't absorb their nutrients. They can't digest their foods. They're having all sorts of issues. And then that leads to all sorts of diseases later on, whether it's early stage cognitive decline, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, whether it's autoimmune disorders like MS and lupus. Those things manifest over decades. They don't happen overnight. So if you calm down the gut and people start absorbing their nutrients again, they start reaching a status of function on a cellular level that's phenomenal, and they experience health accordingly. So once you replenish them, once you get them back into health, they might not need to react to their foods anymore. So, absolutely.
Well, I must say, I mean, I'm very, very happy with this interview. I didn't know you before. I saw the book, The Elimination Diet, but we've managed in this past hour, in the two parts, 50 minutes or so, to encapsulate some of the core concepts of integrative medicine. So anyone listening to this podcast can begin to understand the pathway towards recovery. And your book provides additional resources, and there's lots of resources available at your website. That's wholelifenutrition.net, correct?
Yes, it is.
So congratulations. Your book is great. I hope a lot of people read it, access the information there, and begin a process towards healing. Thanks very much for joining us, and congratulations, too, to your co-author and presumed wife, Alyssa Segerston. She also was instrumental in creating the great recipes, correct?
She's an absolute genius in the kitchen, so she can basically take any recipe and adapt it and make it fabulous. So, yeah, we're so excited to share this with everybody, and really, we can't wait to hear people's stories. We'd love them to share them with us about how they have healed from their very traumatic experiences in life by going through the elimination diet. That's really what drives us. We're just two people that like people to feel better.
And one small personal detail, in addition to a busy practice and a book and speaking and consulting, you are also the father of, you told me, five children?
Yes, we have five beautiful, healthy, happy children. And so, you know, when people say to us, oh, we'll never be able to make these dietary changes, our life is too busy, I would say, well, we want to help you. We want to show you what we do in our kitchen. In fact, some of the instructional videos include our kids. So everything is kid-tested and approved. So if you're a busy parent, you know, come check us out.
Okay, I really commend you on your energy.
Yeah.
Because you certainly bring that forward in your book and in today's interview. Thanks very much for joining us, Tom Maltair. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Thanks for joining us. This is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.